This is an ABC podcast.
Dry July begins tomorrow. Maybe you've signed up, or perhaps you've been thinking of cutting back on the booze more generally. Well, you wouldn't be alone. The market for zero alcohol alternatives is growing.
Commissioner Lowry says this July people should consider their drinking habits.
The big beer brands who, with things like low and no alcohol, are really trying to keep their brands in the face of people.
Wine producers are keen to capitalise on this growth.
He says those aged between 18 and 44 are twice as likely to consume no or low alcohol products compared to those over 45.
Are you giving up drinking for a few weeks this month? How are you finding it? It may be dry July, but alcohol is entrenched in almost all parts of Australian society and culture. Choosing to not drink is a pretty big thing in this country. It can be hard to avoid this stuff. So hard that this dry July, it's all about which new non-alcoholic wine or beer you should stock your fridge with. But there's a growing interest in staying dry past July, or experimenting with drinking less, the sober curious. Drinking rates have been going down in Australia, but rather than us becoming more moderate with our drinking habits, it's like we have two extremes. I'm Sarah Allerley, and this is Rear Vision. So how do we develop this drinking culture? Is the only way to moderate to not drink at all? And are we seeing a real shift? Is Australia's drinking culture actually changing? One of the most destructive roles of alcohol since colonisation has been introducing First Nations people to grog. But this episode focuses on the rest of Australia's relationship with drink, because alcohol has been important across Australia since colonisation. So what are the colonial roots of Australia's drinking culture? What happened when white people came here? Well, when the first fleet arrived, there were reportedly debauched scenes as soon as the boats unloaded in 1788. Heavy drinking played a pivotal role from the very start of colonisation.
The first fleet arrived, but Governor Phillip was a meticulous list maker, and he was very conscientious of the fact that he was going to the other side of the world, with no communication with England for who knows how long. He wasn't sure, he wasn't confident of the soil here. Will the wheat grow? Will the fruit trees grow? So he made sure he had 2 years' worth of very carefully rationed out food for everyone here. But despite that, the Marines that came to escort the First Fleet insisted and finally got their way and had 4 years' worth of rum on board. So on board the First Fleet was 2 years' worth of food, 4 years' worth of rum. My name's Matt Murphy. I'm a full-time fireman and a part-time school teacher and a hobbyist historian who's had a book published called Rum, A Distilled History of Colonial Australia. It didn't last 4 years, didn't last close to 4 years. And let's not forget, convicts weren't allowed to drink, but they did. So, they were encouraged, you do this for me, I'll give you a nip.
It's been, sort of really important in commercial terms and in health terms right from the beginning. And of course, at the same time, it had this incredible impact on Aboriginal people.
That's Richard Midford.
I'm a clinical psychologist. I work in private practice. I have a long history as an alcohol researcher working at the National Drug Research Institute, and I still hold an adjunct professorship at the National Drug Research Institute. The Rum Corps was in the early part of the 19th century, and it basically was the soldiers of the colony controlled the alcohol, access to alcohol in the colony.
I mean, alcohol was a currency. So if you want something done, you had to pay for it. How are you paying for it? With booze. There's lots of records of just people buying things with rum or selling it for rum. I said, buying Pyrmont or selling your wife for rum. We're talking to 1788 till 1812. Yeah.
And it's not just rum, is it? Rum is the word that's used to describe.
Rum is a generic term, really. And I didn't know that at the time, but brandy's brandy and gin is gin. Beer, of course, is a lesser drink. It's beer, but everything else was rum. So they were making rum from potatoes. They're making rum, in inverted commas, they're making rum out of peaches. Everything, hooch, backyard rubbish. Yeah, let's not forget. I mean, people died on the spot drinking some of this stuff. They went blind, and it was pretty nasty stuff. Nowadays, we understand terms like addiction or alcoholism. Those terms didn't even exist back then. I need my rum to start my day. Like, people need their coffee today. My convicts won't work unless I give them a nip in the morning and a nip at lunchtime. It was a need. It was just endemic. It was everywhere.
Where was the alcohol coming from?
Well, I said, apart from making it yourself, which the Irish were very good at when they arrived, the good stuff was coming from Jamaica, the okay stuff was coming from Bengal, and the absolute putrid rubbish was coming from Brazil. The big rush on rum finished in the 1840s. The wheat that was mainly being used to make rum was now being siphoned off to feed people, make bread. We also saw the drop in the convict population. So our rum consumption really started to flatline then. It picked up again during the gold rushes, because people are celebrating. It's worth noting as well that during in Melbourne in the 1850s, there was more champagne in Melbourne than everywhere else in the world combined, real champagne.
After 107 long days, Sydney and the rest of the state is now out of lockdown.
Our politicians have a tradition of making alcohol very Australian, from their own drinking habits to the places they pick for press conferences.
With his fresh do, Dominic Perrottet marked the state's reopening with a beer with his ministerial mates.
It is a freedom day. It is. I mean, people are going out for the first time.
One of the first things the New South Wales Premier did when lockdown ended was grab a beer at 11 a.m. The message was clear. Leave your homes at last and head straight to the pub. Matt Murphy says the attitudes of politicians have been a major influence on our drinking culture over the generations.
My favourite story, and it is my favourite story, was John Norton was elected in a by-election in 1898, and he entered New South Wales Parliament and was drunk every day, disgustingly drunk apparently, to such a point that about 2 months later, he downed his dacks and pissed on the parliamentary carpet. True story. You look at our Parliament, our early parliaments, the drunkenness in Parliament that was just accepted. Our first Prime Minister, Edmund Barton, his nickname was Toby Tosspot. He was a drunk. I mean, these things were considered endearing. They had a full election the following year. He got voted in with a larger majority. He was an outright drunk, our first Prime Minister.
Any little noises that you may happen to hear are only static. It's just something wrong with the system.
John Kerr, our famous Governor-General, disgusting Melbourne Cup speech when he's really drunk at the Melbourne Cup.
I want you to understand, and I know that you will, that the minor noises do not destroy the marvellous occasion today is for me and for my wife.
I mean, Bob Hawke, he said himself that, his most endearing attribute to all Australians is his world record drinking a yard glass.
But it is changing. This wouldn't happen now.
I tell you what, any boss who sacks anyone for not turning up to die is a bum.
These days, an Australian Prime Minister wouldn't get away with encouraging workers to skive off with a hangover. But Bob Hawke's remark after Australia won the America's Cup in 1983 became legendary. Prime Minister Bob Hawke actually put his drinking aside when he was elected and stayed sober until he left politics. Drinking culture has remained prominent in Australian politics, and there's been much discussion in the past year or so about how this has played out in Canberra.
One of the problems with the culture in Canberra is that you've got all of these people, politicians, staffers, away from home, stressful environment, late hours, too much alcohol. It's not a healthy working environment.
The stuff that's come out of Parliament and what we know about what's happening in there is just another example of a kind of boozy workplace culture where there's not been the restrictions put in place to help people kind of come into the modern era where we do think about women and people from culturally diverse backgrounds and people who don't want to drink and people who don't want to be around people who are drunk at work, for example.
Nicole Lee researches and advises on alcohol trends, policies and treatment. She's an adjunct professor at Curtin University's National Drug Research Institute.
I am also the CEO of a drug and alcohol consultancy called 360 Edge, and I'm on the board of Hello Sunday Morning. I think that many workplaces don't think about alcohol and their responsibilities around alcohol when they host a Christmas party, for example, or their responsibilities when they send people out to network and there's alcohol involved, like what happens then and should people come back to work and how much should they drink. That stuff's only really been very recent.
My sense is that I think that the consequences or the understanding of the consequences in corporate Australia are probably better than they are in the political sphere. Private industry has recognised for a long time that you've got to be very careful about being permissive in terms of consumption of alcohol. You know, the long Friday, you know, lunch with a lot of alcohol is I don't think is much of a feature of corporate Australia anymore. And also, you know, corporations, if something happens while you're on the clock, who's going to be responsible? Is it the individual or is it the corporation?
Drinking has been a pretty important way for journalists to stay connected with politicians and their minders.
Political culture is very much about networking. It's about social events. It's about, you know, getting the right people in the room, that sort of thing. And I think alcohol is the lubricant in that sort of situation. And that's been historical. There's this sort of sense of, you know, of largesse, that, you know, to make this thing prestigious, to make people want to be there, you know, providing alcohol in large quantities is part and parcel of that. And I think that that needs to change.
And how do you change that culture of alcohol being so dominant and so widely socially acceptable?
Limit how much you make available. And you have to sort of give, it's partly that sort of physical stuff of availability, but it's also what is going on now, I think, you know, right at this moment, is that the media is really calling it into question. So people feel that they've got to make changes so that they don't feel that they're out of step with what the community expectations are. I think there's been a lot more community discussion of those issues. Certainly, I think, because of what's happened in Canberra in recent years, I think that that's come about.
So binge drinking hasn't just been common around Parliament. Heavy drinking has a long and varied history across Australia. But government policy around closing times has also been blamed for fast and furious drinking over the generations.
At last, 6 o'clock closing has been pushed into obscurity in Australia. Tonight, South Australia joins all other states in abandoning the 6 o'clock swill.
The 6 o'clock swill was when punters downed as many beers as they could between finishing work and pub closing at 6 p.m. 6 o'clock closing was introduced in 1916 to try and get men home to their families earlier.
Tonight, Adelaide loses its perhaps unfortunate reputation interstate as a wowser city.
The 6 o'clock swill ended in South Australia in 1967. And it finished a few years earlier in the other states.
The new era in South Australian drinking has begun.
It lasted a long time. It lasted from the, you know, the time of the First World War right through, in some states, right through to the 60s. It partly came about because of the temperance movement, because, you know, they were basically, you know, wanting to cut down on alcohol consumption. But it really came into place during the First World War, in major part because people felt that the home front shouldn't be having a good time while the boys were away fighting in France.
Oh, it's all right for some people, I suppose, but I really think if I'd actually gone to the vote, I wouldn't have voted for it.
Why?
Oh, no, I think a lot of homes will suffer.
In what way?
Oh, I think, well, little kiddies are left and then, like, getting what's name, I think it'll break up a lot of homes.
The temperance movement was very successful in America because they had prohibition during the 1920s. It never reached that level in Australia.
The other thing Australia introduced to reduce drinking was actually the wine cask. This was in 1965.
Because the wine cask was invented to preserve wine, not to drink it more quickly. Yeah, the guy that invented was a guy called Angrove, and the idea was that when you take the cork out of wine, it immediately starts to oxidise, immediately starts to go off. And so the average person would rather, you don't want to tip it down the sink tomorrow, you drink it now. So people are getting drunk quicker because why waste that wine? And if, you know, wine does go off, it's not going to be well good tomorrow. But the idea of the cask wine, there's a bladder in there, so the more wine gets drunk, the more the bladder shrinks, so it doesn't oxidise. So he actually created an idea to preserve the wine, but it quickly became just a convenient thing to stick under your arm and, you know, take to a party.
Well, exactly. When I heard that Australia had invented the cask wine,
yes,
I was like, oh, my goodness, you know, because you associate it with binge drinking.
Binge drinking, yeah, you know. Of course. But that's not what it was invented for. Yeah.
The thing that sets Australia apart from, say, European countries is the level of binge drinking, and the kind of goal is to get drunk. And that tends to be less of a culture in, say, some of the European cultures. We've developed this understanding that alcohol is part of virtually all entertainment in Australia. And that culture is sometimes hard to break.
Nicole Lee points to various law changes over the years that have helped reduce drinking, taxes, availability, and advertising.
Restrictions on those things have really helped to shape over the last, 30, 40, 50 years, have helped to shape the drinking culture, and it is decreasing. We've certainly seen a decrease in particularly the number of young people drinking.
In other countries, sometimes alcohol is very cheap and very available, yet they don't have the drinking culture that we have. So why is it that we can't have alcohol so readily available and so cheap?
I mean, the nature of culture is that it's like intrinsic and it's pervasive, through society. And somehow we've developed this fairly high-risk binge drinking culture. But actually, we don't have more problems than other countries. We just have different problems. So those countries where alcohol is really cheap, they have a culture of drinking perhaps more sensibly when they do drink, but they still drink at high levels and they have much, much more longer-term problems. So I think the problems are just different.
Richard Midford says the challenge is how widely accepted it's always been to get drunk.
It's really important in terms of influencing consumption to consider what the cultural norms are. If you've got a very permissive culture where alcohol is seen as not a problem, it's seen as something that makes life good for you, or that bonds with your mates, etc., then you can have a much higher consumption than where people are more cautious about it. There was a very strong culture of going out and deliberately getting drunk. And, if you have that sort of culture, the sorts of harms that are going to occur in terms of violence and sexual predation are going to be much higher if you sort of go out and say, well, I'm going to have a drink, but I'm going to have a meal at the same time, and I'm not going to drink too much because I don't want to get picked up for drink driving. If you don't change the culture of a community, you will always have people who need to be treated. And that's where I think prevention is something that people tend to overlook, because it doesn't necessarily produce immediate results. But if you can change the culture, you can change the drinking culture, if you can make low-risk drinking, low levels of drinking, different patterns which are safer in terms of drinking, if you can change that, you're not going to be throwing up the people who will need treatment. My particular interest is how do you work with communities to change the culture so that the community is supportive of low-risk drinking.
Yeah. So how do you change that culture then? And where are we at in Australia in terms of changing that culture?
We're doing reasonably well, and some of the things that are in place really support that. If you think about the revolution that occurred when they brought in breathalyzers in terms of drink driving, that I think has really changed people's patterns of behavior in terms of drinking and driving. And it's also changed the culture. It's unacceptable I'm over the limit, but, I can get through. They won't catch me.
So we still have this culture of getting drunk, but also just of a drink or two being part of social events.
We've kind of got that sense that if you go anywhere in Australia socially, that there'll be alcohol there and that you're expected to drink it.
It's still assumed that we all drink. The standard thank you or congratulations gift is, let's be honest, a bottle of bubbly.
In, global surveys, we're often well up there in terms of consumption per capita and the number of people who drink and the number of people who drink at risky levels.
How did we develop this drinking culture that requires a dedicated month to being sober?
In some ways, we really had no hope of it not being an intrinsic part of our culture. It really started from a very early stage.
It's the only drug that people have to justify why they're not taking it.
Countless people in the bush have reassessed their relationship with alcohol as a result of her work.
When you're growing up and your dad actually teaches you to drink beer because it's a life skill you kind of need to know, people don't trust you if you don't drink beer.
When you go to meet somebody, you do it at the pub. When you go to talk about things, you do it at the pub.
I come from a long line of drinkers, I guess, where that was the done thing, that's what men did. Just got stuck in a cycle of it that just kept growing and growing.
People in the country drink more than people in urban areas.
The further you go away from a major city, the higher the drinking level and the higher the risky drinking.
Australian women are drinking more than ever overall.
They've kind of nearly caught up to men, and then also having problems with it.
Especially women in their 40s and 50s.
There is some indication that people in middle age are actually drinking more, and a lot of that is driven by women drinking more.
And then there are different habits among Indigenous Australians that often get lumped into one.
I think the interesting thing about First Nations people as a whole, if we make some generalisations, is that fewer First Nations people drink than compared to the general community, but those that do drink tend to drink at higher levels. So it's a slightly different way of drinking. There's more people that are abstinent from alcohol, but more people also that drink at risky and dependent levels.
Why is that?
Almost certainly some factors of colonisation, of, you know, stolen generation, of trauma, all of those things are linked to higher alcohol consumption. And it does tend to be the case when, you know, an alcohol culture develops, it's really hard to shift that culture.
But Australian drinking is going down overall. So what's going on? There's been a fascinating shift in the past couple of decades with one particular demographic. It's the habits of this group that's making us all look like we're drinking less.
Drinking rates going down is nearly entirely driven by young people. Teens and people in their 20s particularly, people in their 20s are still the heaviest drinking group, but fewer of them are drinking, and those that do drink are drinking less and they're starting later. And we've seen that's not just a one-off thing in the last couple of years. We've seen that trend for nearly two decades now. So the reduction in drinking is really driven by young people who seem to have lost interest in it. We've seen this kind of shift in the generations where the people who kind of grew up in the 70s and 80s in a much bigger drinking culture have continued to drink and maybe are drinking even more now because they've got more money and they're at the end of their careers. But their children and their grandchildren are drinking a lot less, and fewer of them are drinking as well.
Is there a large cohort of people who have just stopped drinking completely or never started drinking completely, or is it that more people are drinking less?
There's a bit of both. Yeah, there's certainly particularly young people who choose not to drink at all. They may have had some drinks and then decided that it's just not worth the money or effort or time or the hangover. And there's most of it's driven by people starting later and drinking less when they do drink.
And what do you think is driving that change? It's quite a big shift.
It is a really big shift, and we don't know for sure what's driven it. There's a lot more talking about it. It's a lot more visible when there's problems, and those problems are more often reported on. But I think there's a bit of an element of people having children a bit later, so well after their own kind of heavy drinking period. And so the modelling of more sensible drinking is more available. Whereas if you have kids in your 20s and you're still drinking a fair bit and, you know, going to backyard barbecues where you're with all your friends and drinking heaps, then your kids will see that as well.
I think school drug education is important. It's not taking the line of, you know, don't drink at all, saying, you know, the safest thing is not to drink, but if you do drink, here are the ways you can keep yourself safe. And I don't think it fits with their lifestyle the way it was. You know, I just don't think that, you know, going to the pub with your mates is such a big issue anymore.
So with the reduction in drinking amongst young people in the last two decades, could any of that be put down to alcohol being substituted for other drugs?
That's an interesting theory, but the data also shows that young people have reduce their illicit drug use as well. I also feel like younger people are much more ambitious than my generation. You know, CEOs in their 20s, they're really focused very early on success and work.
He says while no or low alcohol beer has been pretty close in taste to the full strength version for a while now, wine has lagged behind.
So young people are drinking less than previous generations. But a much more recent trend in our drinking culture is the sober curious. And Australian winemakers are tapping into this new mindful drinking.
They are a lot better than they used to be. Now that said, there is a long way to go. Wine producers are keen to capitalise on this growth.
The non-alcoholic drinks thing is really interesting because that's really very recent. There's just an absolute proliferation of them now, which is fascinating. And my guess would be there's a bit of responding to the market. So young people still want to go out and enjoy themselves and they want something in their hand while they're doing it, but they don't necessarily want that to be alcohol. So as they do that, it creates a bigger market for non-alcoholic drinks and it kind of happily feeds on itself and people drink less because there is an alternative available. It has become more socially acceptable not to drink at all or to drink less or to drink non-alcoholic drinks at a party or even at a bar.
I think that's sort of two things going on in parallel that contrast each other quite a lot.
Yeah, it is an interesting phenomenon and it feels to me like it's a bit of a cultural shift happening. You know, the New South Wales Premier, first thing he does is go out for a beer, but he's of that kind of middle-aged generation that's still drinking heaps and increasing their drinking. And then there's this other kind of parallel of younger people and some older people as well, but mostly younger people drinking less, being healthier, being, you know, more, they're probably more conscious of their appearance. You know, like alcohol's really the only drug that makes you fat by just taking it. In a culture where we're much more visible to everybody else and appearance is really important, then alcohol factors into that as well.
Young people are much more savvy, I think, about the effects of alcohol than maybe 20 or 30 years ago.
That's Richard Midford. He's a clinical psychologist working in private practice. He's been an alcohol researcher with the National Drug Research Institute at Curtin University, where he's an adjunct professor. We also heard from Matt Murphy, full-time fireman, part-time school teacher and author of Rum, A Distilled History of Colonial Australia. And Professor Nicole Lee from the National Drug Research Institute. She's also the CEO of drug and alcohol consultancy 360 Edge and on the board of Hello Sunday Morning. The sound engineer for this episode was Isabella Tropiano. Music composed by Russell Stapleton. I'm Sarah Allerley and this is Rear Vision.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.